March 25th, 1993. London, England. After getting off a train at the Acton Town Tube Station, 47-year-old Jean Bradley heads towards her parked car, but is murdered by a man who stabs her 8 times. A witness chases after the attacker for several blocks before losing him, but manages to provide a detailed description to the police. 5 months later, a suspect named Frank Marnell is charged with Jean's murder after this witness identifies him, but since a magistrate does not feel that the evidence against Marnell is strong enough to bring him to trial, the charges against him are dropped, and no one is ever convicted of the crime. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be exploring an unsolved cold case from the United Kingdom, the 1993 murder of Jean Bradley. So this coming weekend, I'm going to be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon UK in London, and per tradition, in the week preceding these podcasting events, I always like to cover a case from the host city. Now, if I was to put together a list of crimes from this podcast which appeared to be unlikely candidates to remain unsolved, the murder of Jean Bradley would be right near the top of the list. Jean was a businesswoman who was stabbed to death by an unidentified man while approaching her parked car in the Acton suburb of West London, and what makes this crime stand out is that an eyewitness took the initiative to chase down the killer for over a mile before losing him. Months later, a suspect named Frank Marnell was charged with Jean's murder, and given that this witness positively identified him as the killer, you would think the case would be pretty cut and dried, right? Well, the problem is that eyewitness testimony can often be unreliable, and since there were a number of other issues with the Crown Prosecution Service's case against Marnell, the charges against him would be dropped. While Marnell was not technically exonerated per se, neither he nor anyone else has ever been brought to trial or convicted of this crime, and debate has always raged on about who actually killed Jean. One other potential suspect is notorious convicted murderer Robert Knapper, who was responsible for fatally stabbing at least 2 other women during the early 1990s, but no conclusive evidence has ever linked him to this case. Whoever the perpetrator was, it seems apparent that Jean may have been the victim of a completely random crime, which is what makes this story all the more frightening. Since we just passed the 30th anniversary of this murder, and Jean has never received justice, I thought this would be an ideal case to cover on the podcast this week. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Jean Bradley. Our story begins in England in 1993, and our central figure is 47-year-old Jean Bradley. Jean currently resides in Crowthorne, a village located in the county of Berkshire, located over 30 miles outside of London, and lives with her boyfriend of 21 years, Nick Osborne, who works as a history teacher. She previously worked as a flight attendant for British Airways, and even got the opportunity to serve members of the royal family during special VIP flights. But for the past 10 years, Jean has been employed by an American firm called Precoa Relocation Management, which helps employees from United States businesses relocate to Great Britain. She is now a senior executive within the company, who works as an operations manager for a team of 20 people, and her office is located on New Bond Street in London. Since Jean's job often requires her to work long hours, she has set up a system for her daily commute, which involves driving from Crowthorne to the Acton suburb of West London, and then using the London Underground to travel to her office. She has recently been given a BMW to use as her company car, so in order to ensure that nothing happens to it while she's at work, Jean and Nick took the time to scout the neighborhoods in Acton in order to find a safe place for her to park during her commute. They ultimately picked out a spot on Carberry Avenue, so it has become Jean's daily routine for her to park her BMW there and then walk a few blocks to the Acton Town Tube Station in order to take the train to work. On Thursday, March the 25th, Jean made the commute from Crowthorne to London for what should have been an ordinary workday. At the time, Nick was away on a school trip to Rome, but he and Jean had plans to return there together for a holiday on Easter weekend. After completing her workday, Jean left her office and took the train back to the Acton Town Station. She arrived at around 7:20 p.m., and left the station in order to start walking towards her parked BMW on Carberry Avenue. Jean made a brief stop at a shop in order to buy 2 cans of soda before she completed the walk to her vehicle. She apparently took a few moments to place her handbag and the cans of soda inside her back seat before a man suddenly appeared and attacked her. Jean would be dragged along the pavement for about 12 yards while the man repeatedly stabbed her with a knife which was wrapped in a black bag. While this was going on, Jean started to scream, which captured the attention of some local residents and people who happened to be passing through the area. One of them was a 35-year-old Irish carpenter named Patrick Cunningham, who was driving his van down Carberry Avenue and noticed Jean struggling with her attacker on the pavement. This prompted Cunningham to stop his van and shout at the attacker, who responded by running off. Cunningham then turned around and proceeded to pursue the attacker for the next few blocks. He managed to catch up with the man and pulled the van in front of him in order to cut him off. Cunningham climbed out to confront the man and shouted, quote, "Come on now, you bastard, try it with me and not a woman." The man pulled out his knife, which was still wrapped in a black bag, and lunged it towards Cunningham while saying, quote, "You will get it as well, I'll have you." While Cunningham ducked for cover behind a parked car, the attacker darted around his van and started heading down Gunnersbury Lane. Cunningham continued to pursue the man on foot, and they proceeded to have a chase which spanned several blocks and lasted around 10 minutes. The attacker ran through the South Acton housing estate, and at one point, Cunningham grabbed a metal liner from a waste bin and threw it at the man, and it wound up grazing his leg. Cunningham kept chasing the man down Church Road, but he wound up losing him near the Prince of Wales pub, as a passing vehicle temporarily delayed Cunningham from crossing the road and maintaining his pursuit. But while Cunningham eventually lost sight of his attacker, a resident from a block of flats would later report seeing the man hiding and pacing around in the doorway of a separate series of flats on Ragley Close. This location was just over a mile away from the spot where Jean's attack had taken place, and after looking around for a route to escape, the attacker then headed up Buckland Walk towards Acton High Street before he disappeared. While all this was going on, another witness had called the police in order to summon medical assistance for Jean. But by the time paramedics arrived, it was too late to do anything to save her, and Jean was pronounced dead at the scene. It turned out she had been stabbed a total of 8 times in both her front and back, and one of the stab wounds pierced a lung. The murder weapon was either a butcher's knife or a carving knife, which was believed to be 8 inches long, and since Jean had a number of cuts on her hands, she had clearly attempted to put up a fight against her attacker and grab his knife. Jean's killer was described as being a gaunt white male who appeared to be in his late 30s or early 40s and was between 6 feet and 6 feet 3 inches tall. He had a pale face which included drawn-in cheeks, prominent cheekbones, and a large nose, as well as 2 days' worth of stubble. The man was dressed in a 3/4-length gray-colored parka coat and black pants that seemed too short for him since they were flapping above his ankles while he ran. The most unique detail was a fisherman-style rain hat the attacker wore, which is commonly known as a sou'wester. Even though sou'westers are generally made of oilskin, this one almost appeared to be made out of black trash bin liner, and since it had not been raining that night, it seemed incredibly odd that the man would be wearing one. According to Patrick Cunningham and the other witnesses who saw the attacker, he did not appear to be physically fit, because when he came across some railings during the pursuit, he never attempted to jump over them, and instead took the long way to go around them. Since Nick Osborne was still away on a school trip, he was notified about Gene's murder while in Rome, and took a flight back to London as soon as he could. Nick told the press that he was planning to marry Gene at some point in the near future, and stated, quote, "My life revolved around her. I am totally, utterly shocked. I can't think of any reason why anyone should do this," end quote. Everyone was left completely perplexed about the potential motive for Jean's murder, as she was not sexually assaulted and nothing was stolen from her, as her handbag was left lying on the backseat of her car. Only 3 weeks after the crime took place, it would receive national exposure when it was featured on an episode of the popular BBC TV series Crime Watch UK. Investigators from the Metropolitan Police made a public appeal for viewers to come forward if they had any information about Jean's murder, as they displayed a composite sketch of the suspect, as well as a photograph of an 8-inch piece of black plastic bag which had been found at the murder scene. It likely belonged to the bag which the killer had wrapped around his knife, and had a distinct gold floral pattern on it, as well as the words "extruded," "printed," and "in the United." Following the broadcast, investigators received information that the logo on the bag belonged to a manufacturing company located in the county of Ayrshire in Scotland. This particular bag had been used by a health food shop and a photographic company on Fleet Street in London, though it was no longer being manufactured at that point. A £20,000 reward was offered for information by Jean's employer, Precoa Relocation Management, and given how many witnesses had seen her killer, police figured it would be fairly easy to make a case against him once he was identified. Well, on August the 27th, 5 months after the crime, a 39-year-old suspect named Frank Marnell was charged with Jean's murder. Marnell was unemployed and living in London's Northolt suburb, and was first brought to the police's attention following the airing of the Crime Watch UK episode, as some viewers believed that Marnell fit the description of the perpetrator. He also had a history of mental illness, as he claimed that when he developed a heroin habit years earlier, it caused him to start suffering from bouts of psychosis which continued to plague him. At the time of the murder, before he relocated to Northolt, Marnell had been sharing a house with a friend in the Chiswick district about 2 miles outside of Acton. When questioned by police, Marnell did acknowledge that he may have been in Acton during the same week Jean's murder took place, as he had recollections of waiting for a girlfriend at the Acton Town tube station. During his interrogation, Marnell said, quote, "As far as I know, I have not committed a murder." But when investigators asked if he could have blacked out and committed a crime like that without remembering it, Marnell did acknowledge that it was possible. The main reason Marnell was charged with the murder is because Patrick Cunningham positively identified him as the man he had chased through Acton. Cunningham was brought in to view a police lineup containing Marnell, and when asked about his initial impression of him, he stated, quote, "The minute I walked through the door, he caught my eye." While Cunningham studied the lineup of suspects for 8 minutes, he ultimately picked out Marnell as the perpetrator. Two other eyewitnesses who had been driving through the area when the crime took place also looked at the same police lineup and identified Marnell, with one of them stating they were absolutely positive he was the man they saw, while the other said they were, quote-unquote, 98% certain. In spite of the identifications, Marnell entered a plea of not guilty, and on November the 11th and 12th, a 2-day committal hearing was held at Ealing Magistrates Court to determine if he would stand trial for the crime. But in the end, Magistrate Ian Comfort expressed his belief that the evidence against Marnell was not strong enough for the Crown Prosecution Service to secure a conviction, so he ruled that the murder charge should be dropped. Even though Patrick Cunningham and two witnesses had identified Marnell, there were 4 other eyewitnesses who had been in the area on the night of the crime and saw the perpetrator. They were also brought in to look at a police lineup, but failed to identify Marnell and picked out the wrong suspect. There was no other corroborating evidence linking Marnell to the murder, and he also seemed to have a fairly strong alibi. The committal hearing featured testimony from a woman named Joan Brown, who ran a church social club which Marnell belonged to. She claimed that around 6 p.m. on the evening of March the 25th, she went to Marnell's house in Chiswick in order to deliver him some blankets and pillows. Brown confirmed that Marnell answered the door for her and that she remained at his residence for the next 4 hours and did not leave until around 10 o'clock. If Brown's testimony was accurate, then this would have conclusively eliminated Marnell as a suspect, since Jean Bradley's murder took place at 7:30 that night. Both Brown and her husband were positive that this visit took place on March the 25th, since they both left on a wedding anniversary holiday the following morning. Additional testimony was provided by a female friend of Marnell's flatmate, who said she stopped by the house that night in order to deliver the roommate a book about blood disorders which she had just checked out from the library, and she was certain that Marnell was there when she arrived. Her testimony seemed to be corroborated by library records, which showed that she had checked out this book on March the 25th. Magistrate Comfort ultimately believed that Marnell's alibi testimony had more credibility than the eyewitness testimony identifying him as the killer, which is why he ruled that the murder charge should be dropped. After spending 2.5 months in jail, Marnell was finally released, and no new evidence has ever been found to implicate him in this crime. The Metropolitan Police found themselves back at square one, and the investigation reached a standstill, but in 2008, it was announced that they were looking at notorious convicted murderer Robert Napper as a suspect in the case. On November the 3rd, 1993, Napper had committed an horrific double murder in London's Plumstead suburb when he entered the basement flat of 27-year-old Samantha Bassett and proceeded to repeatedly stab her. If that wasn't bad enough, Napper also sexually assaulted Samantha's 4-year-old daughter Jasmine before he smothered her to death, and he proceeded to mutilate Samantha's body and take a piece of her abdomen with him as a trophy. Napper was eventually charged with both murders and would plead guilty to the crimes, as well as 2 rapes and 2 attempted rapes he had previously committed. Since Napper suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, he was able to claim diminished capacity for these crimes, so he was sentenced to an indefinite detention at Broadmoor Hospital. It was not until November of 2007 when DNA evidence linked Napper to the murder of 23-year-old Rachel Nickell. This particular crime took place on July the 15th, 1992, as Rachel was walking her dog and 2-year-old son through London's Wimbledon Common before she was attacked by Napper. He proceeded to sexually assault Rachel and stab and slash her a total of 49 times in front of her son before he fled the scene. After he was charged with this crime, Napper wound up pleading guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility, and he continues to remain incarcerated in Broadmoor to this day. Since Rachel Nickell's murder took place only 8 months before Jean Bradley was killed, and both victims were stabbed multiple times, Napper was questioned as a potential suspect in Jean's death, but thus far, no evidence has been found to implicate him. So after 30 years, there are still no conclusive answers about who is responsible for the murder of Jean Bradley. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So as you might recall, 3 weeks ago, I released an episode about the Florence Salon murders, which took place in 2001, and involved 3 women having their throats slashed inside a salon in rural Montana by an unidentified man. And one thing that case has in common with the murder of Jean Bradley is that they both had eyewitnesses who saw the prime suspect and described him as wearing a long overcoat and an unusual hat. In the Florence Salon murders, the suspect wore what appeared to be a top hat or wide-brimmed fedora, and here, the perpetrator wore a sou'wester, which would ordinarily be worn by fishermen or people setting foot outside in a heavy rainstorm, even though this crime took place on a completely dry night in which there was no rain. And of course, the descriptions of both these suspects led to the creation of some very creepy composite sketches. Another thing both these cases have in common is that someone was charged with the crime, but the charges wound up being dropped before they could go to trial, as the evidence against them wasn't particularly strong. What makes these murders particularly terrifying is that they may have been completely random and committed by someone who had no connection to the victims and just wanted to kill someone. Jean Bradley's death is all the more sad when you consider that she and her spouse did a lot of planning to ensure she had the safest possible commute to work. Even though she was driving a BMW at the time, they still felt that Carberry Avenue in Acton was a safe enough location to leave her car parked for the entire day, yet this is the exact spot where she was violently attacked. Theoretically, if G was specifically targeted, the killer could have been lying in wait for her because she took the same route to work every day, and they knew she would be returning to her car at that particular time. But from what I can tell, investigators never found anything in Jean's background to suggest that she had enemies who had a motive to harm her, so it seems very likely that Jean was ambushed by a complete stranger and may have simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time. After this crime took place, a lot of the original media coverage compared it to the unsolved murder of 43-year-old Penny Bell, which I covered on Minisode number 19 of The Trail Went Cold. This crime occurred just under 2 years earlier on June the 6th, 1991, as Penny was stabbed 50 times inside her Jaguar in the car park of the Gurnell Leisure Center in the Greenford suburb, which happens to be located only 3 miles away from Acton. Prior to the discovery of her body, motorists had seen Penny struggling inside her vehicle with an unidentified male passenger who was presumed to be the killer, though no witnesses actually saw anything happen in the car park or this man leaving the scene after he stabbed Penny to death. Much like with Jean's murder, Penny was not sexually assaulted, and her handbag was left behind in her car, so no one could figure out a motive for the crime. I still rank Penny's case as one of the most perplexing I have ever covered on The Trail Went Cold, as nothing about it makes any sense. There were enough similarities to suggest that Penny and Jean may have been killed by the same perpetrator, but it seems like investigators have always believed there is no real connection between the two crimes. Indeed, unlike Jean's case, there is some evidence to suggest that Penny's murder was not random and she may have known her killer. As she was leaving her house that morning, Penny told some builders that she was running late for an appointment, even though no appointments were listed in her records. And 3 days earlier, Penny withdrew £8,000 from a joint bank account she shared with her husband, but never told him about it, and this money has never been accounted for. So it's possible that the money was connected to this so-called appointment Penny had, and if this person stole it from her, that could have been their motive for the crime. I don't get the sense that there was any sort of elaborate setup in Jean's murder, which is why these cases may not be connected after all, but it does seem like there were quite a few cases of women being repeatedly stabbed in seemingly safe public places in London during the early 1990s. Of course, another infamous example of this was the 1992 murder of Rachel Nickell, which also got mentioned in some of the initial media coverage of Jean's case, though investigators once again seemed inclined to believe that there was no connection between the crimes. It would be 15 years until Robert Knapper was finally charged with Rachel's murder, which led to speculation that he may have also been responsible for killing Jean, but we'll talk more about Knapper in a little while. So the detail which really makes this case stand out is the eyewitness Patrick Cunningham, who took the initiative to chase down Jean's killer for over a mile or so. It sounds like when Cunningham happened upon the scene, he initially assumed that this man was attempting to sexually assault Jean and was not yet aware that she had been stabbed several times. But even so, Cunningham still took a huge risk since he came face to face with the killer at one point and was nearly stabbed himself. For the first 4 months following the crime, Cunningham shied away from the spotlight, and his name was not released publicly until he finally agreed to do an interview in hopes that sharing his story might help lead to new information to catch the perpetrator. He came across as a very humble and modest person, because even though police hailed him as a hero for what he did, Cunningham still felt bad about not being able to stop this guy. And if you believe that the killer was Robert Knapper, then Cunningham's statement is all the more poignant, since Samantha and Jasmine Bissett would have been spared by being murdered by Knapper just over 7 months later. But Cunningham's involvement would turn out to be one of the sources of controversy in this case, because it was his positive identification of Frank Marnell as the suspect which led to him being charged with the murder in July of 1993. While the charges against Marnell were dropped by the end of the year, it sounds like the Metropolitan Police and the Crown Prosecution Service were still leaning towards him being the right guy and would have charged him again if new evidence surfaced. Not surprisingly, this led to a lot of media coverage on the topic of eyewitness testimony in criminal cases. I know I must sound like a broken record because I've made this statement countless times on the podcast, but eyewitness identification is notoriously unreliable. Yes, given Cunningham's close encounter with the killer, you would think that his positive identification of Marnell would be reliable, particularly since two other eyewitnesses were certain that Marnell was the guy as well. But this is pretty much canceled out by the fact that four other eyewitnesses who were in the area that night saw Marnell in a police lineup and failed to pick him out. Since there was no other corroborating evidence to link Marnell to the murder, I think this generated a lot of reasonable doubt with the Crown's case against him. Yes, it is true that Cunningham had a face-to-face confrontation with the killer, but that does not mean his memory would be infallible if he was asked to make an identification 4 months after the fact. I mean, how many cases have you seen on Unsolved Mysteries where an eyewitness saw a missing persons poster and were absolutely convinced that they had spoken to or directly interacted with this person on an earlier occasion? But then it turned out the missing individual had already been dead by that point, so the eyewitness was mistaken and had mixed them up with someone else they saw. While Cunningham pursued Gene's killer for about 10 minutes, he mostly would have seen him from behind at a distance. And even when Cunningham had a face-to-face confrontation with this man, it was dark outside, and he also had his face partially obscured by a distinct hat. Since the man was coming at Cunningham with a knife, I'm sure it was a stressful, high-adrenaline situation in which Cunningham was not too focused on the finer details of the suspect's appearance, so when asked to recollect this situation months later, his mind may have played tricks on him. Hell, Cunningham even admitted that when he looked at the police lineup of suspects, he still had to take 8 minutes to think things over before he identified Marnell. Another controversial aspect of this case which may have influenced Marnell's arrest were the reenactments of the crime, which were featured on the episode of Crime Watch UK. After the charges against Marnell were dropped, writer Hugh Hebert published a column in the Guardian newspaper titled The People's Peep Show about the popularity of true crime shows on television. He claimed that Marnell was initially brought to the police's attention by some viewers who watched the Crime Watch UK episode and thought he might be the killer because he resembled the actor in the reenactments. Well, this prompted the show's producer to write an angry letter to The Guardian, who claimed that these tipsters submitted Marnell's name to the police not because of his resemblance to the actor, but because he happened to match the description of the suspect which was provided by eyewitnesses. Even so, I've always wondered if this sort of thing has ever caused serious issues for unsolved cases that are featured on true crime shows. I know that during its earliest seasons, Unsolved Mysteries always went to the trouble of making the reenactments as authentic as possible and often found actors who bore a close resemblance to the real people in these stories. This is why I'm curious if any of these actors who portrayed wanted criminals ever ran into trouble with law enforcement because tipsters mistakenly assumed they were the wrong person. Well, it's worth noting that when the Crime Watch UK reenactments for this case were filmed, Patrick Cunningham was asked to look at photos of some actors and pick out the one whom he believed bore the closest resemblance to the killer. But since the Crime Watch UK episode played such a huge role in putting Frank Marnell on the radar as a potential suspect, you have to wonder if this whole situation may have caused some cognitive bias for Cunningham when he identified him. Now, another big reason that the case against Marnell fell apart was because he had alibi witnesses placing him at another location during the time period the murder took place. I mean, alibi witnesses are not infallible either, and could easily have been mistaken about the date in which they saw Marnell, but there was some corroborating evidence to support their stories, such as the library records, which showed that the book which was supposedly delivered to Marnell's flatmate that night had been checked out on that particular date. And then there's the question of motive, and why Marnell would have wanted to attack and repeatedly stab this random woman he didn't even know. Marnell was described as having a history of mental illness, and I believe that investigators may have taken advantage of this, since they got Marnell to acknowledge the possibility that he could have committed a crime like that and not remembered it. But as far as I can tell, I do not believe that Marnell had any documented history of violence. He was actually a fairly bright and promising student when he was younger, but when he decided to experiment and try heroin, it seemed to cause a sharp decline in his mental health, though it sounds like he was starting to get his life in order again by 1993. After the charges were dropped, Marnell agreed to grant an interview to The Guardian and made this statement, quote, "People have this stereotyped view of people with mental illness that we carry out all these awful crimes. Being quote-unquote crazy is staring at a beautiful thing for 6 hours to try and take it in, but people don't understand that. The person who killed this woman wasn't quote-unquote crazy, he was malicious, super malicious, which is a different thing." End quote. I have to say that when I started working on this case, I had very little prior knowledge of it, so when I read a basic summary, I figured that Marnell was probably the perpetrator, and he just didn't get convicted because the evidence wasn't strong enough. But after reading Marnell's interview in The Guardian and learning more about his background and the witnesses who supported his alibi, I now find it extremely unlikely that he was responsible for Jean's murder, and I'm glad that the charges were dropped before he had to spend a lengthy period of time in prison. I have no idea what kind of life Marnell has lived for the past 3 decades, or if he's even still alive, but since no one else has ever been charged for this crime, I hope that the stigma of being an accused murderer did not continue to follow him around. I certainly have no objection to the police looking at Marnell as a potential suspect, but I think they just put too much stock in Cunningham's eyewitness identification and should not have filed charges unless the case against him became much stronger. So this leads us to the question, if Frank Marnell did not commit this crime, then who did? While this has often been described as a motiveless crime, since there was no robbery or sexual assault, but let's not forget that Cunningham stopped his van and yelled at the assailant while he was in the midst of attacking Jean, prompting him to run away. We know that Jean was dragged across the pavement away from her car, so perhaps the killer had been planning to sexually assault her before he was interrupted. And if he was planning to commit a robbery, he may have just not gotten the opportunity to grab Jean's handbag from her back seat before he ran off. One of the reasons Robert Knapper has been looked at as a potential suspect in this case is because he brazenly attacked Rachel Nickell in a public place in broad daylight and stabbed her 49 times. It sounds like he just selected her at random and used the opportunity to sexually assault her, so if Knapper was Jean's killer, he may have been planning to do the same thing to her. Another interesting parallel between these two cases is that much like the situation with Frank Marnell, a different suspect named Colin Stagg was initially charged with Rachel's murder before the case against him was dismissed. Stagg's arrest came about after he was befriended by an undercover policewoman who supposedly recorded him making incriminating statements about the crime. But when the case went to trial, the high court judge felt that the police had grossly overstepped their boundaries and committed entrapment, so after the so-called evidence against Stagg was thrown out, the prosecution withdrew its case and Stagg was acquitted. However, unlike with Jean Bradley's case, at least the real killer of Rachel Nickell was finally found and Stagg received complete vindication. Now, even though I just talked about how people suffering from mental illness should not be demonized and automatically assumed to be violent and dangerous, Robert Knapper is obviously an exception to the rule. This is why he spent the past 3 decades of his life inside a high-security psychiatric hospital rather than prison, even though his crimes were undeniably heinous. Even though Knapper has technically only been convicted of 2 rapes and 2 attempted rapes, he is believed to have been responsible for possibly dozens of other assaults throughout his life. So who's to say that he might not be responsible for additional murders, such as Jean Bradley? Now, looking at the composite sketch of Jean's killer, I guess I can see a bit of a resemblance to Knapper, but the age range is a bit off, since the suspect was described as being in his late 30s, early 40s, whereas Knapper would have been 27 in 1993. Even though Knapper was questioned about his potential involvement in this crime in 2008, it's unclear if Patrick Cunningham or any other witnesses were asked to attempt to identify him. But then again, since Cunningham may have misidentified Frank Marnell, I'm not even sure a positive ID of Knapper after all these years would have much weight as evidence. One thing about Jean's murder which isn't clear to me is how much, if any, physical evidence investigators collected which might belong to the killer. While DNA testing was being used as a tool in criminal investigations back in 1993, it was nowhere near as prominent as it is today. An article was published in The Guardian in February of 2003, which stated that blood samples from the case were being tested for profiles that did not belong to Jean, but I'm not sure if they found anything of any value. If they do have DNA evidence, then they could obviously link Napper to the crime or exclude him relatively quickly, since Napper's DNA is on file. Part of me does hope that the perpetrator is Napper, since he's been incarcerated for the past 3 decades and will probably never be released. But my gut tells me that the killer might be someone who has just never popped up on the radar as a potential suspect. Due to the perpetrator's distinct look and his distinct hat, investigators were surprised that no one was able to make a positive identification, which is why they initially speculated that he may have been a loner. For all we know, perhaps this individual is just like Robert Napper and is currently incarcerated for another crime, but the authorities have never put two and two together. Or maybe the killer is now dead, and the only thing which will conclusively link him to the crime is DNA testing if DNA evidence happens to be available. Whoever the perpetrator was, I have a feeling that he did not know Jean personally and just selected her at random as a victim. This was a particularly brutal and frightening crime, and after 30 years, I hope we can eventually see justice prevail. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Jean Bradley, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released an episode about the 1947 disappearance of Army Lieutenant Ray Hickingbotham, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and explored the possibility that he was recruited by the government to start a new life under a new identity in order to perform top-secret work for them. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the disappearances of Michael and Chucky Palmer, a pair of brothers who went missing 10 years apart at different locations. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Laurel, Lauren M., Jonna M., Terry M., and Stephen M. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another podcast, which, appropriately enough, is from the UK, and that's Rock, Paper, Swords. In fact, they generously invited me to be a guest on their podcast, and the episode containing my interview is going to be released this coming Friday, June the 9th, so be sure to check it out.
Hello there. My name is Matthew Harfy.
And my name is Stephen A. McKay.
Together we host Rock, Paper, Swords, the historical action and adventure podcast. We are both best-selling historical fiction authors, and each week we chat about all things historical and anything that could fall under the banner of action and adventure in books, film, TV, and games. We've had some amazing guests over recent months, including Bernard Cornwell, author of The Last Kingdom and Sharp, best-selling author Simon Scarrow, TV celebrity historian and author Dan Jones. We've even interviewed the great flute-playing frontman of Jethro Tull, Ian Anderson.
So, if you're into history, historical fiction, action and adventure, writing, and rock music, or any of the above, we'll have something for you on Rock Paper Swords, available wherever you listen to your podcasts.
In addition to attending CrimeCon UK this weekend, I'll also be appearing at the regular CrimeCon event in America, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a 10% discount on tickets, so in order to purchase them, you can visit CrimeCon.com and use the promo code COLE23. Once again, for a 10% discount, use COLE23. And another reminder that The Trail Went Cold will also be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. We've got another specialized promo code which you can use in order to get a 15% discount on tickets to this event, so if you would like to purchase tickets, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use our promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's True Crime Podcast Festival, and the promo code is TRAIL. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, if any of you listeners are attending CrimeCon UK this weekend, feel free to come over to my booth on Podcast Row and say hi. And for the rest of you folks, I hope you all have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.